Blog Talk Radio.
Sanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye.
Sorry about that, everybody. This is Queen Tahira. I'm having a little problem in the studio. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. Welcome to Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio. We want to thank our sponsors, Manhood Raising Culture, headed up by my co-host on Wednesday nights, Dr. James Jones. You can find Dr. Jones on Facebook as James Jones, as well as the liking group page for Manhood Raising Culture, and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraisedculture.com. Also, please support Arlie Gordon of Unity Design. Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. You can find Brother Arlie on Facebook and on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And last but not least, we want to always remember to never forget our beloved brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines and the families and loved ones and friends that they represent. So please reach out to Unheard Voices, the Free Alabama Movement, and the Free Ohio Movement, respectively, on Facebook and on the World Wide Web at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. So Nana has a house full of grandbabies today. It is Friday night, and I made a commitment to my grandson, especially Tristan, who will be 5 years old next month. So, yeah, he's at that age where he remembers promises from Nana. So I told him he could come over on Friday, and he is on his way to join Aria and my oldest daughter, Amira, for a couple of days with Nana. So tonight I thought we'd check out the art of war for several reasons. We are in a state of war, a war that has been declared upon us and that we are forced to defend ourselves against. And the tactics we use to defend ourselves are important because we don't want to end up making mistakes that could have been prevented. And that's the one main lesson I think we can learn from our history is that, you know, we've gotten caught slipping in our revolutionary practices. And definitely in the year 2018, there's enough political education out here. There's enough people who have stories to tell, good and bad, and we have enough life experience just looking at the past, you know, 4 to 10 years of how things have changed so drastically, and in my humble opinion, not in our favor. So a question was asked to me by one of the brothers who is behind enemy lines, you know, if this government and this whole Constitution, Bill of Rights, everything that we have been indoctrinated with from even before we were born, because our children, I mean, our parents were indoctrinated with the same obligation and I guess willingness to be subjective to our own oppression. And I don't know what it was that struck me about this question differently, because I've thought about this before. We've talked about this before on Sign of the Times, but it, for some reason, resonated differently. Like, how are we obligated to oblige by laws that were never meant to protect us? It never was meant to represent us nor our best interests. But yet we've been hypnotized is the only word that I can really think of that can really describe the brain fuck that we've received by society, by our government, by our teachers. And they got brain fucked too, a lot of them. Some of them are in it, you know, for the same parasitic reasons that the oppressors are and the capitalists are. But some of them got brain fucked too. So I thought it would be a good opportunity for us to listen to The Art of War, just rehash it again. You know, we played it before, we discussed it before, but, you know, sometimes things resonate differently like they did today with me in that particular question. So pen and piece of paper, you know, the teacher in me has to come out, pen and piece of paper, everybody, because I'm sure you're going to hear something that's going to resonate with you, and I hope you do. And challenge me with it. Let's challenge each other with it, because really that's the only way that we're going to think differently and change the paradigm. The paradigm shift has to happen, and sometimes it happens in small pieces, sometimes it happens in big chunks, and it happened in big chunks for me today because it's really been on my mind. I've even asked my daughter the same question, and her response was, If more people thought like that, that we probably wouldn't be so willing to adhere to the laws that oppress us. So enjoy The Art of War, everybody. And if you need me, please feel free to give me a call directly at 513-913-2691. You can reach me on Instagram, queen_Tahira, on Twitter, @QueenTahira, and, of course, on Facebook, @QueenTahira, Sign of the Times, and New Power Radio Network, and about 12 other sites. If you search me, you'll find me. So I hope everybody has a great weekend. Enjoy the art of war. I always do, and I know you will too. So we'll see everybody on Tuesday live and in living color here on Sign of the Times. This is Queen Tahira signing off. If you need me, push one even, and I'll open up your mic. All right, we'll talk to everybody soon. Peace.
Years ago, a Chinese military man named Sun wrote a 13-chapter how-to manual on war. It touches the political, the psychological, the material facts of armed conflict. It has shaped the way wars have been fought in Asia for thousands of years. Its starting point is the stark, plain reality that death cannot be reversed. Weapons, wrote Sun Tzu, are the instruments of misfortune. They should be used only when unavoidable. A government should not mobilize an army out of anger. Military leaders should not provoke war out of wrath. Anger can revert to joy. Wrath can revert to delight. But a nation destroyed cannot be restored to existence, and the dead cannot be restored to life. Sun Tzu Bingfa. Bingfa, the art of war. War is a matter of vital importance to the state, the province of life or death, the road to survival or ruin. It is mandatory that it be studied thoroughly. Sun Tzu Chapter 1. On the surface, it is a collection of simple instructions about how to win a war in China 2,500 years ago. Yet it is still available in all these English translations. Sun Tzu made his way to Hollywood in the 1980s. Oliver Stone lifted punchy lines for the movie Wall Street.
All warfare is based on deception. Sun Tzu, if your enemy is superior, evade him. If angry, irritate him. If equally matched, fight. And if not, split. Reevaluate.
This is the kid. Calls me 59 days...
Sun Tzu's tactics figure into bestsellers set in Hong Kong and techno-thrillers about Japan. His strategies have been adapted for computer games. This one pits him against an assortment of World War I warriors. In Japan, Sun Tzu comics are read on the subway. It's the rough equivalent of reading the illustrated adventures of Aristotle on the way to work. The phrases that have been a 10-year blip in American culture are ideas that have been woven through 2,500 years of life in Asia. At first glance, it seems like Western chess played with fewer pieces. But appearances are deceiving. The figures in Chinese chess move on the lines, not from square to square. Beneath the surface, there are remarkable differences in these two cultures.
It goes right down to the very root of the society, the basic assumptions about relationships, the basic assumptions about life that are so fundamental we don't usually articulate them.
To understand the effects of these differences, we need to understand the world in which Sun Tzu's art of war was born. 770 BC. The Chinese called this the spring and autumn period. It was China's golden age, and it was moving into its decline. Battle was a gentlemanly pastime, quick and played by the rules. When fighting season rolled around, small armies of aristocrats were driven to war in lacquered and gilded chariots. After the battle, the first order of business was sacrifice to the ancestors. A cow or a sheep, or sometimes a prisoner, was cooked in a sacrificial bronze cauldron and eaten in a ritual ceremony. Around 500 BC, battle ceased to be field sport. An example. The Viscount of Wu ordered 3,000 of his men to line up at the front of his formation. In full sight of the opposing army, the men committed suicide by cutting their own throats. The opposing army fled in terror. For the ancient states of Qi, Yan, Zhao, Han, Wei, Qin, and Chu, the spring and autumn period turned into the era of the warring states. For the next two centuries, they killed one another by the hundreds of thousands. War went from being a family business to being an industry. There were now professional generals heading armies. Conscripts went to war on foot, swinging bronze halberds. Technology changed. Archers began to shoot their arrows from crossbows that could pierce a shield 600 feet away. Civil life followed the military life down the path of violence and brutality and excess. In the countryside, cutthroats and robbers waited in bands. Several thousand crimes were punishable by death or mutilation. Castration, branding, slicing off the nose, chopping off the feet or toes, cutting leg tendons and breaking kneecaps were common punishment. Safe inside the courts, there were well-equipped harems, dancing girls, expert chefs, musicians, and acrobats. Itinerant advice givers were also part of the entertainment.
When we think of philosophers in our tradition, we think of people who are, by and large, irrelevant. You know, that the philosopher is a luxury. But in the Chinese tradition, these philosophers were going from state to state as potential coaches in a kind of tournament that certainly by the time of the beginning of the Warring States, it became very clear to the Chinese rulers that to fail to win was to lose, big time. And we're talking destruction.
What we think of as Chinese philosophy all originated during this period as a way to stop the violence. The Taoists turned to nature. Don't flail against the world, they said. Use it. Flexibility is the operative principle in the art of war. The legalists thought strict laws and swift and severe punishment would put the world in order. Confucius went from court to court, pitching a return to the basics, ordered human relationships, self-examination, high moral attitude, and the proper rights. No one was very interested at the time. Master Sun, too, was on the road selling his theory. Sun Tzu was born in the state of Qi. We know almost nothing of his personal life. Professionally, he was General Sun, commander to the King of Wu. Sun Tzu's job interview may be the most famous military story in Chinese history.
His book, in a sense, is advertising his skills. He's saying to a king, war is a very, very serious business. It risks the existence of your state. Therefore, it must be undertaken only after great deliberation, and it must be waged with great skill. And then it goes on to explain that he is someone who is capable of that.
The King of Wu read the Art of War, then demanded proof. Make an army, he said, out of 180 court concubines. After careful instruction, Sun Tzu ordered the ladies to march left. The ladies giggled. He repeated the instruction, repeated the order. The ladies giggled. After the third round of instruction, order, giggle, Sun Tzu ignored the king's protests and beheaded two ladies. The remaining 178 marched left, precisely on cue. The king declined to watch the demonstration.
And Sun Tzu then said to the king, it's very interesting. I mean, you see this as being a story about how punishment can make an army. But as I think about it, I think it's really a story about Sun Tzu's idea of civil-military relations. Because he says to the king, I can tell from the way you've handled this that you are not serious. You say you want to have a great army. You say you want to do all these things, but You don't even understand what you're talking about. You don't know. You don't understand what's involved. So what he's really doing by doing this is saying to the king, you don't understand what the stakes are in war.
The Chinese provided well for their dead. And it is through these well-furnished tombs that we know what soldiers took to war and what citizens used in their day-to-day existence.
Things like toiletry kits and a lot of bowls and instruments for eating. And if the person were a military person, then military texts would be included, and weapons perhaps, and other things that reflected what this person would want to take with them. Very often these things were very practical in nature. You had to live when you're dead.
Engravings on bronzes found in the tombs tell who made them and why. This one was made by a son to honor his father. The son was a dentist. And the Chinese wrote books. Early books were characters written on bamboo strips tied together to form volumes.
The Chinese appreciation of the written word is extraordinarily important. The notion of imperial libraries in the Chinese tradition passed on the wisdom of the tradition in terms of canonical texts, in terms of great books, if you will.
In 1972, archaeologists found a decayed mass of 5,000 bamboo strips covered with characters in a Han Dynasty tomb. Painstaking reconstruction led to a 2,100-year-old edition of The Art of War.
Initially, they begin as sort of a ball of black pulp, and this would be a photograph of the life-size bamboo strips on which the text is written. What this team of scholars has done then is to take this transcribed bamboo strips and put them together as a text. So we see this is the first chapter of the Sun Tzu, and we see that these two characters are missing. We can infer from the other text that this says Sun Tzu. Master Sun says, "Bingzhe guo zhida shi ye," that war is a major undertaking of a state. "Buke bu cha ye," that it must be taken very seriously, that we must investigate it thoroughly.
The Art of War was memorized, copied, and handed down for hundreds of generations. The first European edition was published in France in 1772, and some say Napoleon studied Sun Tzu's Art of War. There are five ways to attack with fire. The first is to burn personnel. The second, to burn stores. The third, to burn equipment. The fourth, to burn arsenals. And the fifth, to use incendiary missiles. There are suitable times and appropriate days on which to raise fires. Times means when the day is scorching hot. Days means when the moon is in Sagittarius, Alpha Rep, E, or Chen constellation. For these are the days of rising wind. Sun Tzu, Chapter 12. Delivery systems have been improved. 20th century war is less labor intensive. Technology has rendered the wait for a rising wind unnecessary. But soldiers and civilians in all cultures still die in the fires of war. Japanese atomic bomb survivors drew pictures and wrote what they remembered of the unforgettable fire. Master Uni, age 80.
A first-year junior high school student asked me to give him some water. I heard that if people who had been exposed to the A-bomb drank water, they would die. The next day when I passed by the place, he was lying dead on the ground. I wish then I would have let him drink water, even if he would have died sooner. I heard in the evening that my child had been calling Daddy, Mommy, and that he had taken his last breath alone without seeing us. It is 29 years since my son died, and his memory and the miserable image of the junior high school boy asking for water always haunts me.
The consequence of war is a constant. The methods of waging war are not. Some argue that war is war is war. Others passionately and intellectually disagree.
You've heard a lecture this morning by Professor Handel about Clausewitz. Clausewitz is usually taken as the exemplar of the Western approach to war. Now, I'm going to introduce you to Sun Tzu. Now, in Clausewitz, Book 1, Chapter 1, Section 2, where Clausewitz defines war, in two paragraphs, you find this word Gewalt, force, used 8 times. The Chinese word, Li, which is roughly equivalent, force. And in the entire text of Sun Tzu, that word is used only 9 times.
The very definition of war is different. For General Karl von Clausewitz, a 19th century German military man, war was defined as use of force on the battlefield. Sun Tzu recognized war as a legitimate tool of statecraft, and force as a legitimate part of war. They're too dangerous to be the method of choice.
What's perhaps distinguishing about Sun Tzu is the sort of the way that he views conflict as a totality. He the war, the conflict that he's talking about in this book includes all sorts of things which in the West would be considered to belong to the areas of politics, our diplomacy, or even peacetime.
There have been 3 major military East meets West encounters in the last 60 years. In the 40s, we fought Japan in the Pacific. In the 50s, we fought in Korea. In the 60s and the 70s, we fought in Vietnam. In none of these encounters did the fighting stop when the shooting ended. War, in the Asian view, is not confined to the battlefield. War, trade, politics, or international relations, they are all tools, all part of the same game, all conducted under the same rules. When the enemy's envoy speaks in humble terms, but he continues his preparations, he will advance. Chapter 9. December 7th, 1941. 1 p.m. Japanese diplomatic representatives were scheduled to arrive at the U.S. State Department for yet another meeting on peace in the Pacific. Japanese military representatives began bombing runs over Pearl Harbor at approximately the same hour. The Japanese may have used Sun Tzu's tactics, but they violated his basic strategy. Know your enemy, know yourself, and in 100 battles you will never be defeated. When you are ignorant of the enemy, but know yourself, your chances of winning or losing are equal. Sun Tzu Chapter 3. Japan overestimated its military strength and knew far less about the American psyche than it imagined.
There's no doubt about the sentiment of Congress. All differences have been laid aside.
1941, a date which will live in
history. We will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
The attack on Hawaii neither awed nor demoralized Americans. They were chagrined and furious at being caught off guard by a tiny Asian country. Americans rallied round the flag. Men enlisted, and women went to work doing jobs men left behind.
Out of every 8 people in America working full-time for victory, 1 is a woman.
Hollywood danced for the troops and sold bonds to civilians.
sell more bonds, Bing auctions a horseshoe worn by Seabiscuit.
$2,250. This is really a handsome thing to have. You're getting this as a premium for a war bond for $2,250. So it's really a good purchase for anybody.
Korea was a different kind of war. 1950. United Nations troops were in Korea to contain communism, to keep an ideological blight from spreading out of Red China and North Korea into South Korea and the free world. Western forces, fighting under the United Nations banner, were in trouble.
The UN forces in Korea had been driven to a tiny perimeter around the port of Busan at the tip of the Korean Peninsula, and the question was how to reverse this potentially disastrous situation.
The American general, Douglas MacArthur, proposed an audacious amphibious landing at Incheon, about halfway up the peninsula just across from Seoul. To be certain to take what you attack. Attack a place the enemy does not protect. Sun Tzu, Chapter 6. Incheon is not a place that cries out for heavy guard. A 10-foot seawall runs for hundreds of yards along the coast. Within a 6-hour space, the tide ranges from a high of 32 feet to a low of 6 feet. A troop transport needs a minimum of 29 feet of water to stay afloat. When the tide is out, Incheon is a mud flat. In trial runs, soldiers were sucked into greasy muck up to their waists. There were 3 days when a landing was possible, and 3 hours on each of those days. The American attack was not entirely a surprise. Mao Zedong predicted the September 15th landing, but the North Koreans disregarded the possibility, and MacArthur's attack was a stunning success. The communist September losses at Incheon were avenged by the Chinese the following November at the northern border where the Yalu River separates Korea from Manchuria. Subtle and insubstantial, the expert leaves no trace. Divinely mysterious, he is inaudible. Thus, he is the master of his enemy's fate. Sun Tzu, Chapter 6. Moving at night, hundreds of thousands of Chinese walked silently across the frozen Yalu River from China into North Korea. Dressed in white, they moved alongside and then behind the American forces. When the Americans were surrounded, the Chinese attacked. The result was the longest retreat in American history.
The goal of a military operation should be is to move your opponent from a state of harmony, which is to say a state in which he can resist you and can think clearly and can make intelligent dispositions and whatnot, to a state where he becomes psychologically disorientated, where control breaks down, where people panic, chaos, in short. The American troops in Korea, some were retreating in good order, but others were simply saying, there are a whole lot of Chinese up there, we're gonna bug out. And the word bug out, in fact, goes back to the Korean War. And they were panic-stricken. It's something that's very, very rarely seen in the American army. People who saw it, you know, remember it to this day.
Vietnam. The view from Marble Mountain is beautiful on a hot December day. Standing on the top, you can see for miles, right down into what was the American airbase at Da Nang. For many young American soldiers, this was the first view of the exotic, unfamiliar land where they would die.
Sun Tzu ultimately sees war as being a matter of deception and psychological dislocation and the attainment of psychological dominance. And what we tend to think of as war, namely fighting, destruction, a sort of active coercion, he sees as being a sort of the sort of second-rate or a less desirable form of war, an imperfect form of war. The essence of war has to do with achieving, with dislocating the enemy psychologically and then making him wax in your hand.
In Vietnam, dislocation came with the territory. It was hot. It was wet. It was dark. The language was strange. And it was impossible to tell by looking who was a friend and who had just planted a mine to kill you. General Va Nguyen Giap was the leader of the North Vietnamese military forces. Together with Ho Chi Minh, he was a major architect of the victory over first the French and then the Americans in Vietnam.
Soviet leaders asked me, the Americans have so many divisions of tanks and artillery and missiles, and how many divisions have you got, General? And I answer, if we have the same calculations as you do, we cannot fight 2 hours, but we fight in the Vietnamese way, and we. GIs come here with their rifles, and I had my own way of receiving them.
General William Westmoreland came of age in the American military tradition. His first exposure to the sights and sounds and smells of battle was fighting German General Erwin Rommel in North Africa during the Second World War.
Every war is different. I mean, I've fought 3 wars. I went through 7 campaigns during World War II, and you were fighting an orthodox enemy, the Germans, and initially the Italians. Now, we're fighting the type of war that, say, the American Army was trained to fight. And then we went to Korea, and we confronted the Chinese. And their strategy and their tactics was considerably different.
坐之动静之理，行之之死生。Agitate him
and ascertain the pattern of his movement. Determine his disposition, and so ascertain the field of battle. Probe him, and learn where his strength is abundant and were deficient. Sun Tzu, Chapter 6. The Vietnamese looked for weaknesses and found them at the place on the map where Laos, North Vietnam, and South Vietnam share a common border. In January 1968, the North Vietnamese Army began a full court press at Khe Sanh. American Marines were at Khe Sanh to defend against infiltration and as a jumping-off point in the case of operations in Laos. Americans were committed to defending Khe Sanh.
At that time, a revolutionary force was quite weak. We used the time to get stronger. The longer the war lasted, the more casualty and death. It was very difficult. We had to sometimes eat the leaves in the jungle. But step by step, we succeeded.
Khe Sanh was the beginning. On the nights of January 30th and 31st, the Vietnamese forces found other weaknesses. Taking advantage of the Tet holiday, they attacked Saigon, Quang Tri, Hue, Da Nang, Nha Trang, Quy Nhon, Con Thon City, Ban Mae Thuat, Da Lat, Phan Thiet, Nhi Tho, Can Thế, and Ben Che. The fighting was prolonged and bloody in Saigon. And it may have been humiliating to have the Viet Cong troops in the American embassy compound. But the real damage, the physical damage, the psychological damage, was done in Hue. The Viet Cong took the Forbidden City and the Citadel. American and South Vietnamese military forces were unable to drive out the communist troops. And in the end, the Americans bombed the grounds until what was once a city of the emperor ceased to exist. Across the river in the residential section of Hue, mass murders and other atrocities by the Viet Cong convincingly demonstrated that the Americans could provide no safe haven. No one, not those in the countryside, not those in the pacified hamlets, not those in South Vietnamese cities, could be protected if the Viet Cong chose to attack. The Tet Offensive created thousands of refugees, refugees whom the South Vietnamese government had to feed and house, heartbreaking refugees, casualties of war, who were featured nightly on the network news. By the end of February, Americans had captured 6,000 Vietnamese and the U.S. military estimated 37,000 North Vietnamese dead.
They were prone to accept major casualties where they would move into action against odds, strongly against them. And casualties did not seem to be as meaningful to them as it seemed with respect to a fight with the Germans. And I would say the same would apply the Japanese were also during World War II. The Japanese, being a part of the Oriental Society, seemed to be more callous to casualties than the Germans or the Western society.
The North Vietnamese had taken a high number of casualties, but in exchange for their losses, they learned that the American public was unwilling to tolerate a large number of dead.
I think in war after war, you find that the turning point is not sort of physical turning point. Rather, it's a psychological turning point. A decisive battle is one that people think is decisive. Sun Tzu's identification of the creation of chaos and disorder in the hearts and minds of the enemy is very, very useful from the point of view of understanding how military operations really work, how wars are really resolved.
When he is united, divide him. Sun Tzu, Chapter 1.
We never have a purely military strategy, only overall strategy involving the economy, politics, diplomacy, military.
There was no land to take, so the American military measured success in numbers. Number of attacks, number of prisoners, number of dead.
I quote a number of meaningful statistics, such as the roads that are being opened, increasing number of enemy that have been killed, the number of defectors that are coming in from the communist side to the government, the number of weapons being captured, and other statistical information which suggests that we are making progress and we are winning.
We are pleased with the results that we're getting. We are inflicting greater losses than we're taking.
The American public measured failure with the same numbers.
Now, there are finite limits to the destruction Vietnam can absorb. There are only so many buildings and so many people. And too many of the buildings now lie in rubble, and far too many of the people lie dead. Laying aside all other arguments, and there are a great many more, the time is at hand when we must decide whether it's futile to destroy Vietnam in the effort to save it.
Unlike World War II, Americans did not rally around the flag. There were no lines of young men clamoring to do their part. In this war, Hollywood was on the other side. At the 1975 Academy Awards, winners of Best Documentary read a telegram of congratulations from the North Vietnamese. Jane Fonda went to Hanoi. The country was divided. Policy was being made in the streets and at the ballot box. In Chicago, at the Democratic National Convention, police battled demonstrators. A president was forced out of politics.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
In Ohio, four young people were killed in a bloody battle between students and the National Guard. Unlike their fathers in World War II, thousands of draft-age men refused to disrupt their lives to fight a war.
In our democracy, to get anything done that is costly in lives or money requires a support by a majority of the people.
He whose ranks are united in purpose will be victorious. Sun Tzu, Chapter 3.
Our aim was not to annihilate the whole American army. Our strategy was to inflict defeats, political and military defeats, on the Americans, so they had to withdraw the forces.
During the whole course of the war, we never lost a battle of any consequence. We probably lost a few small skirmishes, but that was about it. Jupp was a very talented man, and with limited resources, limited to ours, he did an amazing job. But he didn't win on the battlefield.
On April 30th, 1975, the last American flight left Vietnam. The West divides the world into categories. There is business, there is philosophy, there is literature, there is religion, there is order and sequence, a way to take things apart, to isolate them. The East has a different sense of reality.
The Chinese people are much more sensitive to abstract reality. What you learn from spirituality, what you learn from philosophy, what you learn from business, or your family relationship are all interchangeable.
Let's go forward. Let me show you the
real origin of philosophy is come from the Chinese watching nature. How does nature work? How does God work? So once you watch that and know how the rhythm of the universe, and you take that and take it into your business. That's why it's so portable. The sense of the art of war can easily take it to the business world.
For centuries, soldiers have used the tactics in the art of war. They reflect the conditions of armed combat. For centuries, Asians have used the strategies in the art of war. They reflect an Asian view of life. But in the 1980s, Sun Tzu's philosophy moved outside Asia, outside the military, to Wall Street.
The book about war applies to business because the objective in both cases is very specific. The objective in both cases is about winning, and the objective is also about winning with as little effort, using as little time, and with as much reward as possible.
Plunder the fertile countryside to supply the army with plentiful provisions. Sun Tzu, Chapter 7. In the 80s, Asher Edelman was a corporate raider, a new breed of Wall Streeter who followed Sun Tzu's advice. He taught the art of corporate raiding at the Columbia Business School. A raider uses the value of a company he doesn't yet own to buy it. Once he owns it, he can sell it off piece by piece and make a great deal of money in the process.
My view then, and it was an honest view, was that people who did what I did, which was to acquire companies and try to change them to being more efficient and better, did something quite constructive. My view starting in about 1987, 1988 was that it was a simple financial transaction, and though it was quite constructive for those who did the transactions, and sometimes constructive financially to those on the other side of the transactions, my view is it didn't do much good for the companies.
Jackson Steinem.
going places.
Oliver Stone's Sun Tzu on Wall Street was a stylish sleaze named Gordon Gekko.
I don't throw darts at a board. I bet on sure things. Read Sun Tzu, The Art of War. Every battle is won before it's ever fought. Think about it.
Time magazine said Edelman was a role model for the fiendishly greedy Gekko.
There were newspaper articles and publicity of various kinds that if I were really alone in the world wouldn't have troubled me at all. But the fact that my wife, my kids, my mother, and other people who cared about me were reading did trouble me.
Today, Edelman mixes his business interests with directing the Contemporary Art Museum in Lausanne, Switzerland. Edelman may have found Sun Tzu useful, even profound, but he remains a Westerner who divides the world into categories and comes to it as an individual.
It translates easily into certain kinds of activities in the Western world. I don't think it translates at all into Western philosophy. I think that the first translation that I see into Western thought comes from Freud. And the ability to operate in the world through the understanding of oneself is probably the most poignant point in Sun Tzu. That is all Freud is about.
While the Westerner is sealing the world into watertight compartments, the Easterner takes a more holistic view. And that is a continuing source of tension in business and diplomatic relations.
The trick of any game is to have everybody playing by the same rules. And the real injuries occur when one party is playing by one set of rules and the other is by the other set of rules. The important thing is just that we're all in the same field at the same time. In The Art of War, he speaks a great deal about knowing the terrain. Knowing the physical terrain or the economic terrain or the business terrain is really critical to any kind of business or personal victory.
The terrain in the East also includes the mind and the emotions.
Mind game is the most important thing to the Asian, and business is about mind game. Politics is about mind game.
All warfare is based on deception. Therefore, when capable, feign incapacity. When active, inactivity. Sun Tzu, Chapter 1. In the West, rising in the world depends on what you know. If you've got it, flaunt it. Works well here. But pride can make you vulnerable.
As a matter of fact, this is a true story. See, the Japanese technicians will come to the floor and ask their innocent questions. Something very, very simple. And you will not even suspect what their intention is. And then you get the engineer, American engineer, get them to talk. And eventually they will slip in some essential point they really need to know. And you know, normally the American engineer, nobody ever asks them how much they know, and they love to brag. And since somebody else wants to ask them about how much they know, they love to tell all about how much they know, and they gave it away for nothing.
To Westerners, pretending ignorance to collect information seems unfair, a kind of cheating. To an Easterner, that attitude seems naive.
It's get back to the basic. Know thyself, know thy opponents. 100 battle, 100 victory in Chinese to practice that. Espionage is the way to get information. Sun Tzu is talking about pay your spies well, because one good spy is better than millions of good soldiers.
But what Sun Tzu is talking about is a deep psychological understanding of another. Empathy as much as espionage. It's not the kind of information that depends on electronic eavesdropping equipment.
After the fall of Saigon, I went to Saigon and I saw the operational section of the American Armed Forces there. I saw a lot of modern military equipment and electronic weapons and so on. And I said to myself, they have their own logic because they own a lot of modern state-of-the-art military technology. And that logic is fundamentally incorrect. We have the human factor, and it's the decisive factor. It's like Sun Tzu say, know the enemy, know yourself, and you will win 100 battles.
That maxim from Chapter 3 of The Art of War is set in a marble block in the central courtyard of the Sun Tzu Museum. Though the museum itself seems to be designed for the tourist trade, Westerners are as likely to come away with psychological insight as with those gift shop knickknacks. Should someone ask me how do I cope with a well-ordered enemy about to attack me, I reply, seize something he cherishes, and he will conform to your desires. Sun Tzu, Chapter 11. What he cherishes may be entirely invisible and without value to others. Like pride, impatience can be the psychological equivalent of baring the throat.
Chinese feel time is eternal. Time has no value. Things, material, has a price. Time is free. So Chinese always have that going for them, is that they can wait and see, and they can change and wait. American executives always say, give me the strategies. 1, 2, 3 steps. 3 steps tell me how to deal with the Chinese. 3 steps I can use very effectively. And it's really, really difficult. I think it's a lazy way to get the job done.
In an Asian culture, a Confucian culture, who you are depends on what you are. Wife, mother, son, friend, teacher. You are what your role says you are. There is simply no Eastern counterpart to Western individualism.
The idea of you as an individual person pursuing what you yourself want for yourself, in the Confucian tradition would be almost pathological. To act without reference to the web of people who constitute yourself would alienate you from your community and from yourself. You have a morality that is effective within that group, but you don't have either the obligation or necessarily the desire to extend it beyond that group.
If the East is shaped by relationships, the West is shaped by law. In Western law, justice, to be justice, must be blind to existing relationships and ties.
And this is things Americans have no concept of. Because Americans look at the law, we live from a orderly society. What is right is right, what is wrong. In China, everything is gray. Right and wrong is a different, the degrees of grayness. It's not about black and white. The Chinese society sacrificed the small for the large. In the Chinese history, there's a story. A city was under attack. It was so strategically important. So the emperor ordered to hold the city at all costs. And when after they finished eating all the rats, all the trees, all the leaves, all the roots, they started to exchange babies. So I'll give you my baby so you can slaughter my baby and cook it, etc. And the Chinese feel this is the right way to do it. Survival of a greater unit is more important than the survival of a small unit. So when you're talking about good and bad, there's a different culture, there's a different way to label what good is about.
How you judge the morality of this story depends almost entirely on which side of the cultural divide you are. Westerners may find in it an appalling disregard for life. Easterners may find in it a great sacrifice. Failure to understand the way the other comes to that judgment makes the modern world a difficult place to live in.
My own feeling is that we in the United States do not yet grasp how very, very important it is for us to understand, genuinely to understand the rest of the world. And I don't say this because I think we're going to have to fight in the rest of the world, although there is that possibility, but because I think that only with that kind of understanding and detail and ability to operate in cultural systems that are different from our own can we avoid conflict.
Weapons, wrote Sun Tzu, are the instruments of misfortune. They should be used only when unavoidable. Anger can revert to joy. Wrath can revert to delight. But a nation destroyed cannot be restored to existence. And the dead cannot be restored to life. Thank you.
feel that your message, apparent message of love that you brought back from Islam is the real reason they're after you, because you're not hating as hard as they want you to?
Well, I never did hate anybody hard. But I do know that when I wrote that letter saying that there were white people in Mecca, it shook up a lot of Muslims, because most of the Muslims who follow Mr. Muhammad absolutely believe that it was impossible, physically impossible, I should say divinely impossible, for a white person to go to Mecca. And my trip there shattered that image or that misconcept.
Anyone call you directly, Malcolm?
Oh, I've been receiving calls ever since I left the Black Muslim Movement.
And what sort of calls? Malcolm, isn't it disenchanted in view of the fact that these men who were your brothers are making threats against your life?
No, because actually it's not their fault. Most of them, now Joseph and the officials, they have
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means.